apostrophe. I-T-W-I-T. H-D-A-N-N-Y. And J-E-N-N-Y. Doing it with Danny and Jenny. Doing it with Danny and Jenny.
Everyone talks about their desert island tunes and what they could listen to over and over again. That's at the top of my list.
That's a great song.
Yeah. I know. Eli Braden was our.
Wow.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the magic that is Eli Braden?
I feel like I know that name.
If you're a Stern fan, you've definitely heard that name because he has written a lot of odes to Robin's tits.
Yeah. All the Robin's titty songs.
Every Robin's titty. He's an all-star and and apart from that, an all-around great guy.
And you got him to work clean for you guys. That's huge.
We have the one that the Tipper Gore label that we're not. Right
now. Yeah, he took time out from his busy titty writing song schedule to
put
that out for us. So we're very honored. Thank
him on the podcast. I just to talk to him.
Yeah,
be good. But we don't need him today.
No, we never need him
because
we have each other. But also, we have a great guest.
Would you like to introduce our guest? Because I feel like you know Sam better than I do. Oh God, I gave part of it away.
You've already fucking ruined it, Danny.
Yeah. Damn it.
Well, one of my favorite stand-ups of all time right now. I mean, like, you're the seriously one of the best working comics there is right now.
Thank you.
Like,
thank you. I just started working again like a week ago. This is crazy.
Thanks
for having me.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I discussed your specials that you've had come out on YouTube that I'm so impressed with you and also with Mark Norman with y'all's ability to keep doing comedy during this past year. Like every time I'll see a video, it's like you're on a rooftop, he's at a park, or y'all are just.
Mark is like my oldest friend and one of my oldest friends in comedy. And we used to, I've had so many drunk nights with him where I'm like, did you get Montreal this year? And he's like, no, did you? And I'm like, no. And there's so many nights where I'm just like, you're lying, you're going. He's like, no, I'm not. There's so many nights that I've shared with him that he's like, he just fuels me, that guy, because he's such a hard worker. And I've watched him get all the rejections, but all the good stuff too. So I that makes me feel extra close to Mark, you know?
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. I definitely know the people like who I came up with on my side of the business. And you're right. It's like surrounding yourselves with people who are really working hard is the key. I mean, I that a lot of that is luck, you know, you happen to find yourself at the right place in the right time because, you know, you can, I have other friends who sort of, I knew had the potential, but they just, their crew is just not motivated, phoning it in.
Mark is hardcore. You can even tell he's hardcore by how he does his stand-up. Like there's not 5 seconds without a laugh. There's like anxiety in his writing. You can feel it. I mean, he needs a laugh. He needs to be. So I was with my friend yesterday, Matt Salik, he directed my rooftop special, and we were just walking around. He was telling me a story about Mark where they kept getting bothered by a crazy guy in Times Square, and the guy kept bothering him. And finally Mark turns to the guy and goes, "Hey, we're breaking up." And the guy was like, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
That's fantastic.
But Matt said that was just for me. I was the only person that joke was for, you know. But
those are my favorite jokes. I'll do in an elevator to embarrass a friend, or just
right.
Absolutely. That's without a doubt one of my favorite things.
I would say that response also was probably one of the few things that would shut a crazy person down. Like,
yes,
there's not a lot of things you could say to a crazy person that makes them just go, "Oh shit, my wow." Thoughts and prayers for you, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, Mark is definitely a guy. It's you got to surround yourself, like you were saying. You got to surround yourself with those people that are hungry and just want to be. He's so driven by, you know, not by like just success, but like I want to be good at stand up. So that's a good reason to keep him around always.
No,
y'all have a podcast together too, right?
We just started a podcast together called We Might Be Drunk, because I was like, this is a good disclaimer if we say anything horrible. like we might have been drunk. So we have a it's kind of based on that idea that Mark and I used to we used to hang out every night, but then you start doing the road and you kind of start featuring for comics and you start headlining for comics, and then you kind of get one night a week together or two nights a week. Sure. And it would start with like, all right, one drink, and then it would turn into like, all right, one more drink, and then we'd look at each other. It was like 6 a.m. in the Fat Black Pussycat, which is, you know, the satellite room of the Comedy Cellar. And we'd be like, oh, no one threw us out. We're just here, you know? So that was kind of the premise of the podcast, is just like how we just never could. It's so many nights when you're kind of, we say like, you got to get those vents out when you're frustrated about the business, because you don't want to be walking around bitter because people smell that stink on you. But you got to get the vents out, because I mean, how many times we just feel passed over, and like, you know, you say we put our specials on YouTube, but we felt like we had to. That's the cool thing about doing stand up today. You know, in like the 80s, 90s, whatever, you had to wait for HBO or whoever to tap you. But now, you know, I'd still shop it around. I was just curious, but it was all no's. So I was just like, well, I'm still making it. I'm not going to just, I get so sick of material, and I feel like once it's overcooked, it's, I don't want to keep telling the jokes.
Yeah.
We just last week were talking about our own, like, sort of like, you know, I dealt with like a running up against the gatekeeper on a project that by all rights should have gone. It was like, and it was really kind of, I was like, oh, I can still feel rejected. I hadn't felt that in a long time. And it was like, and oh, this is really unfair. Oh, that's right. This is like testicle pain. Anytime you can kind of go around the gatekeepers, it's amazing what, you know, like that these options are open to people like that weren't open when, you know, and certainly when I was coming up. It's great that you're taking advantage of it, man. I really respect it. It's
funny.
You.
Like, well, some people told me not to do it, but then other people, I remember I was talking to Jim Gaffigan one night at Gotham, and I was like, I don't know what to do. No one will buy my special. And he said, just release it. Just put it out. He's like, how do you think? He kept saying, how do you think Sebastian blew up? No one watches Showtime. It wasn't a Showtime special that blew him up. His clips just kept going viral. He's like, clips, just keep clipping them. And I was like, all right.
Exactly. So, I'm glad you said it, because I've had, you know, issues where I don't want to post, you know, like maybe the Laugh Factory will go, hey, can we post this clip of you? And I'm like, ah, that joke, I don't know that I want other people to hear it yet. Or like, do you have a thing of like, what if somebody stole your material, or if it was, would you rather get ahead of it? Like, I don't know. Like,
yeah, I think they're going to steal it anyway. From
people. I think that's a good attitude. I have the same attitude to them. People are going to steal your shit anyway. And can't be precious about that shit. Like, it's like, if you know it's going bad, or if anywhere, just like, I forgot who it's like, I've heard some comics that I respect, and some writers I respect early on when I was starting off. Cause I think everybody's starting off, whether you're a comedy writer or comedian, there, you have this feeling like, oh, someone's going to steal my stuff. And I got stolen from some big people. And I had somebody just say to me, like, you, when that happens, it's just like, fuck them, write more. Like that's it's like, if one joke or slice is so precious to you, you're not writing
exactly.
it.
Like, exactly. Exactly.
I heard
someone, I think it was Ken Levine or somebody told me one time, it's like, nobody's going to make a career in Hollywood off of one stolen joke. Like, you have to, you know, it's like, you could tweet something that you stole, or you could present something that's funny, but you better have more shit to back it up, you know, and. Yeah. Like Sandra Bernhard, one time I heard her like make a comment that, hey, there's more where that came from. You want to steal one from me? Go ahead. I've got a whole, you know, filing cabinet full of shit. You can't just steal one joke and then make a career out of it. But I'm glad that you're doing that, because like, I've been on the fence about like wanting to release more clips.
I just figure like, what the hell, like it's gonna make me write more, because those meme people just take them anyway. I just had a guy in like some kids in like Wales or something, I don't know, I just heard like British accent, they sounded young, and they're just telling a joke, and it was like the joke they took of mine was verbatim in the joke, and I was like, hey man, you know, I saw you get like 5 million hits on this, that's pretty fucked up, and they were just like, fuck you. It kind of was like immediately like, go fuck yourself, I've never even heard of you. And I was like, well you did it verbatim, and it was in a pretty big movie, like it's not like, you know.
What was the joke, can you tell me?
Yeah, the joke was, I said I say women look at sex like buying a car. They're like, can I see myself in this long term? Is it safe? Is it reliable? Could it kill me? And I say men look at sex like parking a car. We're like, there's a spot. There's another spot. Oh, I have to pay? Never mind. And the tag was handicapped. Hope no one sees this. So
that's a phenomenal. What, you said that was in a pretty big movie. What movie was that in?
It was in Joker. It was right before Joaquin Phoenix went on. But I'm like, you took a joke out of a pretty big movie. I mean, and they were just like, fuck you. You're a nobody. Like, if you're so pissed about. So this was like, we're talking about getting pissed about one joke. I was just pissed that they didn't acknowledge it. Like, if you want to be a thief, I at least get to shame you for it. I'm going to keep writing, but I at least.
I kept seeing it.
People kept sending it to me on Instagram and TikTok. And these guys were like, fuck you. So there's like
but
this
wait,
young.
It was in the movie, the joke. This was
it
in
was
the
in
Joker.
The Joker. Yeah. It was in
well,
the movie.
Well, at least, I mean, you have a pretty big fucking. Hey, fuck
no,
you,
but it's just, in. It's more like, yeah. I just get annoyed with young people almost more than. Yeah. Almost more than comics, because any comic knows it's wrong. Whereas, like, there's like young people out there just taking it now, and they just want the instant likes without it. So much is that generation where they're like, we don't want to work for anything. We just want to build up a base, and they're like these curators of jokes they stole. It's so weird to me. So that bothers me. I wasn't like losing sleep over it, but I was like, fuck these guys, you know?
Yeah, well, that's ballsy, man. That's like, really, like, I'm always shocked, like, when people will steal, like, a joke of mine, like, that is already gone viral. Like, it's like, really? Like,
yeah.
You're gonna, that's like, okay, cool. Cause I mean, I don't even have to alert them. I mean, I'm sure your fans are the same way. It's like the police will come out, our friends or our fans, the police will, I mean, they'll hit them really hard.
Yeah. That's great about social media is you do have your fan base to go like, I'll get so pissed. I'll see somebody just literally copied and pasted my joke. You know, it's like, that's 100% mine. And then just as I want to say something, I'm like, you know, just be bigger, ignore it. And then I'll look and all the people that follow me are like, fuck you. That's Jenny's fucking joke, you piece of shit. How dare you still? I'm like, okay, good. I don't have to.
Yeah. Now I mostly just let those people get pissed, but I'm also, cause it's not like it's a winnable fight, but cause no one respects the idea of intellectual property theft anyway. So it's not like a winnable fight, unfortunately, but I was like, maybe I'll just make NFTs so I can profit off. Like, I'll do an NFT of the joke they stole and try to profit off them. That'll be the idea. I'll use the nerd tactic on the nerds.
That's amazing to make an NFT of a joke, of a meme.
Like, I was thinking of it.
Okay, let's talk after the thing. I want to get involved in
this. Right. So, Sam, how did you get started in comedy? Like, what was your...
I'm dying to know your origin story. Like,
I want to know give us a rundown.
Well, I'm from New York City, so I would go to the club sometimes, but I always, for whatever reason, steer clear of the Comedy Cellar because I was just so scared of it. And it's funny, I watched a Patrice O'Neal documentary last night, and I was like, this is why I was scared of it, is these dudes. But I would go to, you know, Comic Strip or Caroline's. I remember seeing Dave Attell at Caroline's, and it changed my life. I still have the playbill that Attell signed in my room.
What year are you starting out?
I want to say it was like 2003 or four that I went. I probably started in 2005, but yeah, Attell was headlining, Big J Okerson was hosting, and Chelsea Handler was featuring. I remember the show. And Attell, I just thought he was a genius. I still do. I think he's the funniest person I've ever met. But so that was big. And then I started doing the mics, and they were horrible, but you have those friends who are like, you're funny, you're funny to them because you can do like inside jokes, you can do callbacks, right. you have so many tactics you could use, but
winning them over in 30 seconds on a stage.
Yeah. So it took a minute, and I like dark jokes, so they were bombs early on where it was like, it wasn't just like they didn't like the set, they were like, we don't like you. So there was a lot of those. So a lot of handing out flyers for years on the street and a lot of that stuff. And
wow.
And yeah, I went to school. I went to Tulane for a minute, but I ended up coming back to New York because I wanted to do stand up. So starting in New York is kind of a blessing in a weird. People always said come from a small scene and then move to New York when you've got heat. But I've seen those guys. Sometimes I've seen them move here, like Hannibal Buress, and they just things go great. But I've seen other comics move and they were the guy in their scene, and nothing really happens. You know, it's not guaranteed. So I would rather just in New York, people always say, well, they see you when you're weak. It's like, yeah, but you know, but you get so much. Yeah. It makes you stronger too. So I was okay with that.
That's where like, I did stand up like briefly poorly. But I started when I was like, I grew up in Jersey, just outside the Lincoln Tunnel, town called Livingston. And when I got my license at 17, I went to the comic strip and I did their open mic and I did, and like, I got passed there and I got passed at the improv. And this world isn't even a comedy seller at this point. This is because that's a long show.
Wow. But, comic strip though. That's all. Was it Lucian or no?
Yeah, it was Lucian. He was very nice. My the very second time on like a Monday night at, you know, and I lied about my age, but on a Monday to be there on Monday night. And I even brought a couple friends. It's like, yeah, I'm going up on Monday night. It's my second paying gig. And he's like, hey man, we're going to bump you. It's like, you can hang out though. It's good comic coming up. And it was like only my second time on that scene as like to get the $5 basically. And it was Eddie Murphy.
Oh my God.
And Eddie Murphy came on and did an hour. And it was like, that special, yeah. Like the hottest thing at that point. And it was like, and I had to follow him.
Wow.
I'm seven.
Were they cool to you? Sometimes they're cool though when a really big name drops in, because they're like, vacation is made, you know?
Yeah.
He was in and out. And then the audience was polite to me, but I was completely freaked out.
Wait, did he do it? You said he did an hour?
Yeah, he did an hour.
I mean, after that happened to me at the Cellar. The audience is gonna like be like, "Whoo, shit! We just had
they were wild." And it wasn't like, it was basically like it was one of those situations where he came on a Monday night. It was like, maybe half the house full, but because he was doing an hour, enough people were telling. It was before cell phones, but enough people were like letting other people know, "Oh, Eddie's doing this," and so that it was starting to fill. He filled it up in the hour, and then everyone was immediately leaving. And now
that's rough.
Yeah, he's angry. But it was interesting though. I mean, it was like to watch and said, "Oh yeah, this is next level. I'm not that."
That happened at the Cellar one night. It was Rock Chappelle, and for whatever reason, Chappelle never gets off early. But he knew there was another show, so he got off early. So they were like, "Sam, do you want to go do 10 now?" And I was like, "Of course, yeah, of course, I want to follow Chappelle and Rock. It's awesome." To just and the crowd, of course, they got up, a lot of them, because they were just like, "Yeah, is it Ray Romano? No, okay, we're good. We can get up and pee." So
Ray, hold on.
But then once they settle, they're good.
Sam, was there a moment in that, because everybody knows that journey you go through where, you know, you're grinding it out, you start to get better, you're building material, you get more confident. But was there a moment when you're like, oh, this is the career? Like, did you like that? Like, I can make some money at this. What was that for you?
Huh? You know, I won this festival in Atlanta called the Laughing Skull Festival in like 2010, I think. And it was probably like, I don't know, I want to say like 60 to 80 comics there, but it was 600 applicants or so. So I was like, all right, I made the 80, which I was happy about. You had to pay your own way, which sucked though. I remember sharing a hotel room with a comic, and I made it out of the first round, like barely. I just barely made it out of the first round. Then I made it out of the second. And then I won the third round, and I don't think I should have. I think this guy, Tom Simmons, had a better set than me to this day, but they went with me. And that just guaranteed me road work for like, entire year. Yeah, it was the best prize you could give a young comic, because they were like, you will either feature in certain clubs and you'll headline the maybe C rooms that we get you booked at. But I was like, headlining at that point was foreign to me. 24, probably 23 or 24.
Wow, that's heady, man.
So that was when I was like, oh, I'm working. And I did. I was working some of the gigs suck, but then I remember one of the weekends was with like Marc Maron. I'm featuring for Marc Maron. I was, you know, so.
And how was he to you?
He was a little rough around the edges at first, but it's funny. I think I told this story. He ended up being really nice, but I just did his podcast and I told this story to him. And I said, you know, first time I saw you, I was so intimidated by you, because he was wearing a fedora and sunglasses and smoking a cigar by the pool. And I was like, who is this guy? You know, I knew obviously I was a fan.
He had a fedora. But
yeah, it was such an intense look. I was like, this guy looks so intimidating. So he ended up being really nice and cool. And we ended up having lunch a couple of the days. But some of those weekends were clubs that they kind of took a chance headlining me, and they either liked me or they didn't. I remember one club, it was a good room, and they were like, you're not a headliner yet. They kind of just, they didn't say it, but I felt it. And then another room in Kirkland's, it was weird. I remember doing this. I was so nervous. I don't think I had 50 minutes. So I was like literally every joke I've ever thought of. And I remember the guy watched my set and I got off stage and it went well. I was so happy. It's like, oh my God, I did really well. And the owner walks up to me and he goes, what the fuck was that? And I was like, what? And he goes, we're a family establishment. And I was like, I don't know what I said. I don't know what I did. And then I didn't know what to change. So I didn't have the material. So I did the exact same material the next night. And he comes up to me and he goes, you really pulled it together. And I was like, what are you? I don't know what you're talking about.
You probably just dropped nervous F-bombs. Like,
maybe
that's what you're like. I don't know. That's strange.
It was so weird, but he ended up booking me a few more times after. So certain clubs, they were like, you're in now. But I do worry, you know, it's tough. There's that weird period when you go from feature to headliner where clubs or middle act, I guess, for people listening that don't know the jargon. But they don't you kind of have to turn down some feature weekends because clubs would go, why would I headline you? You're featuring this club. And I have to be like, that is true. Why should you up my pay if you know you could get me to feature? So you had to hold out for a minute. You had to like kind of massage those B rooms and work your way in.
Yeah.
I didn't have an agent. I was booking myself. It's funny. I heard stories about in the 90s, you went to the Montreal Comedy Festival and you leave with like a $750,000 holding deal. By the time I went, they were like, you might get an agent. I was like, all right, I'll take it.
I remember that was like, God help us. I worked on her show.
Everyone's leaving with like their own pilot and
their own like pioneer was like Brett Butler. Like this guy David Tochterman saw Brett Butler at Montreal, and then it's like, okay, you're doing Grace Under Fire, and
yes,
and boy, she ruined a lot of our lives. But
she was tough.
Well, tough in the sense that like Hitler was tough. mean was tough. Yeah. She
damn.
I always say like. A tenth as funny as Roseanne, but 30 times as mean and crazy.
Damn.
So, just saying something. Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. But, Annie talking shit. That never happened.
Yeah, I hear she's better. It was that was a rough time for us. God bless her. I hope she's doing better now.
Sam, who's your influences? Who are the comics that like you love growing up, and who are the ones you like now? Like who are your?
I mean, I could say the obvious ones because obviously I love Pryor, Carlin. Dangerfield was huge for me because he was just so like you couldn't look at him without laughing. So I love Dangerfield. I love ones that people wouldn't think. Like, I love Search for Signs of Intelligent Life. I love Lily Tomlin. I love
that too, man.
She rules.
I wouldn't think that with your comedy. That's interesting.
Oh, dude, she just it's funny. Sometimes I remember watching a comic once and the booker turns to me and he goes, I bet you don't like her. And I was like, cause I laughed and he goes, oh, I wouldn't think you would like her. And I was like, I forgot who it was on stage, but I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, you're so different. I was like, you assume I only like people like me. Like what kind of narcissist do you think I am? Like I see stuff that I can't do. And I'm like, that's what I like a lot of the time. So,
I was more about your age, frankly, that it's like, so like just like, that was like such of its time. And, I mostly like watching people who do something I don't think I can do.
Totally.
Right? You know, like that's like, I'm in awe of this particular kind of comedy you're doing, because it's like in a million years, that joke and that bit would never have occurred to me. And
that's how I feel, because like someone like, it's tough. You dabble I go back and forth with, I love that. If I watch Pryor, sometimes I just think I can't do comedy. I remember I was really high in college and I watched the Chappelle special. Fuck, what's it? Killing Him Softly.
Yeah.
And I remember watching it high and I just freaked out. It doesn't agree with me. I just started freaking out and thinking, I can't do comedy. I was like, I can't do this because what he's doing is so foreign to me. That's how good he is. So
it was self-doubt. Weed just like, it does not give me the confidence. It seems it's a performance inhibiting drug, I would describe.
Oh my
There's
God.
No way. Completely. Like if I had an edible or something, like I could, in a weird way, sometimes I can write better jokes because I loosen up all the neuroses that I might have, but there's no way I could perform. Like where people, I don't understand how someone,
so many
like
comics do it.
I know.
No way I could do it. I have to be in a safe space,
I get performing on like an upper or something that was like getting
right.
But like the idea of like anything that's sort of like a depressant or slowing my brain down. It's like, oh no, I
can't. Well, I can perform drunk. I can't perform high. And I'm not as good drunk, but I'm on the late show. If they're all hammered, I'll have a drink or two sometimes. And
you're probably not drunk. I can't have I'll have a drink when I'm on stage too, but that's just to like cut the edge. But I wouldn't be drunk.
You can't have one too many otherwise. Like I remember I was in Las Vegas at the Tropicana, at the Laugh Factory that was within the Tropicana. And I had shows like from Monday to Monday, and there was three shows.
Oh, the word. Why do they do that to us?
I don't know.
It's a like, week in Vegas? No one plans for a week in Vegas. That's a brutal amount of time.
And I don't like, and I'm not a Vegas person either. So like,
You have a soul.
Yeah. So the last show, I mean, it was like the third show of the night. Everyone's hammered. I was having a few drinks like in between shows and on stage. And then I realized like, I'm kind of like fucking tipsy right now. Like I was on stage, like shit. And then I said a joke and I was like, I swear, I think I just said that already. Like, did I just say that joke? Because I've already said it twice on stage. It fucked with my head that I started going like, oh shit. Uh-oh. I need like somebody to get the hook. And I'm like, wait, did I just, and then I just let go. I was like, fuck it. Did I just tell y'all that? Do I need to? No, we're good. I couldn't be even remotely buzzed on stage because that would be the.
And it's happened to me so many times because some clubs on the road used to do the three shows in one night. So you're doing three different hours. And by the third hour, I'd be like, you know, I need a drink just to survive this. So by the third hour, I would definitely repeat a joke. And then you just have to own it. You either say, I'm sorry, I've done two shows, or I just say, or I just tell it a third time and see if it hits. You know, I just keep telling it to see how many, I don't know. So I'll just figure anything out, you know?
I'll tell you one thing that you do that I have so much respect for, because every time this happens to me, I feel like I get a little too nervous, but you crush at crowd work. Like every time I see you do crowd work, you absolutely destroy. Like, is that something that you like to do, or is that?
Yeah, I get bored with my jokes, as I said. Like, I don't go in being like, let me do crowd work. But some comics will scoff at crowd work, and I've never been one of those comics. As long as if you're trying to do it in an original way, I just hate the same tricks. But if I get heckled, I'll roll with it. And if I'm bored with the jokes, I'll definitely talk to the crowd a little bit just to keep it conversational, so it doesn't feel like a completely scripted show they're seeing. Most crowds, I think, need some engagement.
Do you think that when like people heckle you, because I've seen your clips of you doing crowd work, and it's some of my favorite shit. I just wonder, like, is the audience going, I want to be insulted by Sam? Because sometimes I can't even imagine the shit that people shout out. And then you just,
I don't know. I don't know if people do that. I can't tell. My friend made that comment to me, but sometimes people say it to me off stage. People just, I think sometimes they think every comedian's an insult. I never would think I'm not an insult comic at all, but I was doing a show yesterday, and at the urinal, this guy turns to me, he goes, you better make people uncomfortable tonight. And I'm just like,
like this
you're doing to me right now.
Yeah, like, I'm uncomfortable. Yeah. But some people, they think that's what I want. They think that's my goal is to, I'm like, no, I don't want to make, I want to, I've heard comics be like, I'm not an entertainer. I'm a truth teller. I'm an entertainer. I'm trying to make people laugh. I know I'm there to move drinks at the end of the day. So I'm not getting some inflated ego.
I'm a truth teller is a rough, I've definitely been privy to a few, Emmy speeches from somebody on the stage or something talking about, you know, this is about, you know, this is a revolution that we're doing here, you know, just like, fuck you, Amy. Like, you don't get to say that about your own work.
Especially in showbiz people are so fucking phony. Oh, so I mean, like you're talking about pitching shows to people. You're like, this is not, I know you don't behave like this at home. I know this is a put on. It's tough. It is tough. Really woke people. I'm not one of those comedians who's like, oh, woke people, but like really woke people.
Yeah.
There is something that is, it's hard to entertain them because
like
I'll do shows and it's become a cliche, but I do shows in Brooklyn and it's like, there's a standards and practices in their head and they're like, let me see if this flies. And then they decide it's okay. But those crowds, like at least I'll take road crowds. Cause at least a drunk crowd, I can do something with energy. I can't do anything with a just, I can't do anything with that.
Yeah. You know, the woke crowds are like the equivalent of, like, if my mom watching me at a dancing recital as a kid, and she's just watching for the shit I could possibly fuck up. Like, does she not smile? And she's like, the woke crowd is just waiting to wait for the thing that they can get offended by. They're not listening at all or watching the show. They're just waiting for you to say, like, ooh, did you just say that's actually a racist term? And you're like, no, it's not. You just made that shit up. Like,
I know.
That's how I feel about the woke crowd. Is it's just like
a But to answer your question though, with the crowd work, I like doing it because on the road they just kind of don't think. They're just drinking and they're just laughing, and it kind of feels like you stepped into a portal or something, and you went back to a time. Because I love doing New York comedy, but there are certain rooms that get a little too. They're like these hipsters who are just too cool. It's not just woke, it's like they're kind of above it, and you kind of want to be like, you came like you
didn't. That's what I don't understand, like
comedy snob kind of thing.
You know, it's a comedy club. How can you be that? I mean, I also think, like, when people are, like you said, like crowd work gets like a rap from like from hipster comedians, they'll be diminishing crowd, but I think it's just diminishing bad crowd work. Todd Barry's, that whole crowd.
Oh, man,
that,
yeah.
I laughed so hard at that shit. And good at it. You know, it's just because, no one likes Where Are You From, you know. And with no joke, like what I just said.
Todd's a crowd work master, but have you ever tried texting with him? It's just like, hey, meet me on my block at this restaurant. I'm like, oh, I can't right now. You just made the plans with me this second. And he'll be like, ouch. And I'm like, you're the best crowd work comedian working, but that's what you get every time. Ouch.
He had one of my favorite tweets about like maybe 2 months ago, and it's right in that wheelhouse, but it was like it was to comics. What's the craziest name of a place you've ever performed? And his was Sydney Opera House. Just to brag.
That's so funny. That's so great.
Todd Barry. It just made me laugh.
My mom loves Todd Barry. She thinks he's hilarious. He's
one of my favorites. I honestly, his performance, his attitude, he's just like, because that level of confidence in that, I just like, it works exactly. It's great. It's just.
He's great.
His albums are great. I love all. I like listening to comedy, and his albums are just perfect for that because of his voice and because of his tempo, and he kind of, there's this kind of jazzy sound to it. I love it.
I get so excited if I just see him pop up in something I'm watching, like there could be a movie, like he gets some role that maybe something small, but I'm like, no, more Todd. I won't. Every time I see Todd in something, he's so enjoyable.
He was another guy, like people I listened to as a young comic, Todd, Dave Attell, Greg Giraldo, Chris Rock, like all those guys. I mean, obvious choices, but I mean,
Greg Giraldo, man.
Hedberg.
Hedberg. Well, just for sheer jokes. Like, before him, it was like, I remember being like a kid and like a Stephen Wright would come on and just be like,
oh man,
how are you writing these jokes? It's like, these are just.
How do you fill an hour? That's the question. Is like, that's a near impossible style to maintain. Like, that's why I give so much credit to Anthony Jeselnik, because it's like the guy just keeps putting out hours and he's doing that. It's those one liners.
I've featured for him a few times, and like, I mean, I'm so enamored by the fact that it's like Stephen, just jokes. It's like setup, punchline, setup, punchline for an hour, and it never misses. You know, it's just boom, 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 boom the whole time. I'm like, that's like some just complete endurance on stage that you're watching. Cause I'm more, I do a lot more storytelling, which, you know, it's like that, I don't want to say waste time or eats time, but it takes a lot longer. Where Jeselnik's like for a full 60 minutes is just boom, 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 boom. It's incredibly impressive.
I'm in awe of that. So I was seeing that you did America's Got Talent.
Awful experience. Yeah, I was just desperate. I think I just needed.
What year was
it? I was, I want to say 2015 or something. I maybe 16. I really was desperate to just move tickets because it's just hard. It was hard at that time for me to get headlined. I had for a long time been getting my own dates. Then I had an agency, and the woman was I was at Paradigm and she was awesome. She hustled so hard, but she just didn't have really the clout to get, and I didn't have the clout to get me booked really. So that was, they ended up folding their, basically their public appearance division. So I go to Innovative and these agents I had were so fucking rude to me. They would just write, I'd be like, man, this is really low money. And they'd be like, well, that's what you're worth. Like, what is this? What is this? Devil Wears Prada? This is crazy how you're talking to me. So they were crazy. One of them still pops up. One of them's a manager now. And they were the worst. They were rude. Mark was with them. They were assholes to him. Rachel Feinstein, some of my best friends. So it's like, and then I moved to William Morris and they were good. That's who I'm still with. But they were like, we can't get you enough weekends because they knew I just wanted to be on the road every weekend. So yeah. I did AGT and it was a horrible experience. I remember being so, I get anxious. So I'm not good for that. I'd already done Last Comic, which is a horrible experience for me. And then I get there. I'm at some theater in Pasadena. It's like 5,000 people. And they fuck with you because they want you to be anxious on camera. So they're like, right before I went on, they're like, are you nervous? They keep being, are you nervous? And I'd be like, yeah, I'm nervous. Of course. And I could tell they want like, the judges, you could just sense their arrogance kind of, except for Howie Mandel and Mel, you know, it's really just Simon. Howie Mandel is such a nice guy and Scary Spice. I to this day, I think was a little bit flirting with me, maybe just for the cameras. But so I go out there and they 5,000 people. And I'm just like, they can cut this however they want. I can look horrible. That's why I tried to give them nothing off screen. I was like, maybe they'll just show my stand up. That's all I want them to see. I know it's like 10 million viewers. So I couldn't have done better. I kind of opened by just, they asked me questions about stand-up. They said, what's your worst gig? I told a story about a guy spitting on me during my set. And I feel like they were like, we hope you do well. I feel like that was able to get me some goodwill. Oh, I got a standing O. I killed. And I've never gotten a standing O ever. Like it's never happened. But so it's like, it's a put on, but
yeah,
I killed. And even Simon was like, I didn't want to like you, but I did. I'm like, why? Why don't you want to like people? Like, what's wrong with you?
What? I got to be a Teletubby for you to like me.
Yeah. I love that. So then sitting here hosting talent. It's like, look, I don't want to like any of you.
They
like,
keep saying to you, they fuck with you. When you're waiting backstage, they go, Simon's in a really bad mood. I'm like, yeah, me too. I've been here 12 hours. He's got a fucking limo. And I'm like, what are you talking
about? $1 billion fucking dollars. And I'm sitting here shitting my pants and you're not helping.
He's furious, this guy. So then I go to the next round and the whole time they're like, we don't know if we're going to air it. And I'm like, I just got a standing O on your show after the hell you put me through. And it's like, and my mom is hilarious. I'm freaking out. I'm texting my mom. Like, I can't. I'm freaking out. I've been 10 hours already. And my mom will say, just read a book. And I'm like, Mom, there's a snake to my right. There's a couple dancing Mambo number 5 to my left. There's no, I can't just escape. I can't just pick up a book. So I end up going to the next round. They decide we'll air it. But they end up airing it as one package. I moved to the next round. And it's a horrible situation. I'm really cranky. Cause I'm in this hotel with construction. So I get like 2 hours of sleep and then I'm there for 12 hours and they mess with you. They're like, there are other comics there. They try to get me to shit talk them. And I was like, I'm not doing that. And then they try to get you you excited. If you win, you get to go to Vegas. I'd be like, I hate Vegas. Don't want to go to Vegas. I just want to get a few sets on TV. Finally, I get to the last round. It's like 12, it's like midnight. I've been there for 12 hours and the crowd's exhausted. They're giving nothing. And I do, that set is online. I do pretty well. I get like an applause break or two. I do pretty well. And at the end, they're like, Simon's like, yeah, you were all right. You were better last time. And I'm like, they were better last time. I still fucking, it's been 12 hours, dude. So I ended up getting eliminated. This mime Tate Face, who's incredible. He's an incredible mime.
Yeah.
He moved on and they like pit us. I hate that they pit us against each other because I thought he was amazing and super hilarious. I see him the next morning without the tape on his face. And he's like, I really like you, mate. Yeah, you're good. You're a good act, I was like, Tape Face is got like a cigarette in his mouth. But yeah, terrible experience. I was super bummed about it. And I don't like reality TV. It's painful for me because it's so. It's funny. It's reality. It's the fakest TV you'll ever see.
I was going to say, it's the most unrealistic. It's all scripted. It's all predetermined of how things are going to go. There's no real reality in it.
I saw Howie Mandel in Montreal a few months later and Howie Mandel walked up to me and he goes, you really got screwed. You were really funny. And I was like, you're the judge.
Howie. Did you get an AGT bump at all? I mean,
because they aired it, and they aired my first set and my second set together, I guess, to do like a package of me. So it was like a 4 or 5 minute segment, and it's like 10 million viewers. So it was probably the biggest bump. Like, no late night set gets 10 million viewers. So it felt like three late night sets back then in one. So it gave me a little bump for sure. Oh, but they're not loyal fans. They're AGT fans. They they're with you for like a minute. You know, they don't stick around.
They jingle their keys in their face, and then they're like, "What? Something shiny?" And then they leave.
Yeah, we can't make your show tonight. We're seeing a sword swallower in the same town. Sorry.
Yeah, brutal. The puppet guy, the Jeff Dunham guy. We want him.
Wait, you mentioned your mom, and I had really enjoyed when you were running your material by your mom and posting videos of it. Is that something you do? I know you were doing it during the quarantine, but is that something you do in real life? Like, do you run?
Yeah. I'm really close with my mom, and we talk on the phone all the time. So I'll run bits by her, and she's a great audience, because if she thinks it's funny and I think it's funny, I'm like, all right, I think it's broad. It's definitely going to hit. So, cause I want it to be funny to as many people as possible, but most important, I've got to think it's funny. But if it's funny to, you know, she's got good taste, and I would listen I'd listen to Hedberg with her. She loves jokes. So we'd listen to Hedberg or Stephen Wright, or she thought Dimitri Martin was really funny, or she loves Ryan Hamilton, who's one of my best friends.
I just saw his special recently. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's really, she likes a good joke. So I trust her with it.
That's great. I just very much enjoyed watching you run material past her, because I talk to my mom all the time, and I run stuff by her, but she just doesn't know it. I just make it like we're in conversation, because if I told her, hey, let me tell you this potential bit, she'll start getting in her head about it. But if I just am talking to her casually and I tell her something and she laughs, I'm like, all right, make a note, that worked, okay, because she's like the hardest audience of all time.
Yeah, my mom was- that's really funny that I feel like Jim Jeffries would never, like, I've opened for him a few times. I remember he would never be like, here's a bit, which most comics I know would be like, hey, can I run something? He would just he'd be like, have you ever noticed this happens? I'd be like, I think he's running a bit by me.
My mom was the opposite. Everything I said, my mom laughed. It was like the worst possible audience. I came out from my dad balanced it by thinking I was a complete piece of shit most times. So it was like, she filled the gap, but she was a terrible judge of like what was going to be like. I was like, oh yeah, I'm killing with my mom.
Yeah. My mom thought it was funny. What the hell's wrong with you?
But it's tough, because it's like, what am I going to be like, my mom liked that joke? The only jokes I can't tell her are the ones about her. And then I'll tell her those jokes afterwards, just to make sure she's cool with it. But she usually is like, oh, well, what am I, like a big joke to you? But she'll be laughing as she says that, so I know she's okay with it.
I let my mom know after the fact if she's made her way into any of my material. But then she's such a narcissist. She's like, so am I just all, is it all you talk about is me? I'm like, no, let's take it easy. It's not that.
That's so funny. People always, whenever someone's like, I hope I don't make your act, I'm always like, I'll never think of this conversation with you again. It's always like some person like I talk to for like 30 seconds and like, hope I don't make the act. I'm like, I don't know you. What are you talking about? But then it's like the people that don't expect it. Like, my mom never expect, but she's seen bits where she's been horrified for sure. I've definitely seen her. She was at my first album taping at the Comedy Cellar, and I told this pretty salacious story, and I watched her put her head down in like in horror. And I'm like, mom, you're fine. I don't want to see your, don't sit up front if I have to see your face hating the joke.
Like, who was the person who staffed the audience? I mean, like,
I guess she wasn't up front, but she was close. She was in eyesight. It was enough that I was like, I need her out of eyesight.
Yeah, I wouldn't even want to know. My mom's never even seen me do stand up, because if I tell her, I'm like, if you want to come, don't tell me, just be there.
Yeah,
just show up, because it will be all I.
That
think
would
about.
Freak me out though too, because I don't want her to see me. If my mom comes, I don't want her to see me just dicking around with new jokes. I want her to be like, oh, he's still got it, he's still got his fastball, you know. So she's seen me bomb before, and I think it's been, I remember she saw me once at Stand Up New York, and it was one of the, that club, just no one policed the room. So if you got a heckler, you better hope you shut them down and they understood that you shut them down. Otherwise they weren't going to stop talking. So yeah, she just watched me go at it with a person for like 15 minutes and there was no resolution. It was just me arguing with them. And I was just like,
you're just in a bar fight.
I was like, all right, I guess you want to get dinner now, mom? And she's just like, oh, that's terrible.
Unbelievable. Well, we're at the point where we talk about on our show, we're talking about stuff that we've been watching. I know we've been hitting that stuff. Before we get to that, though, is there anything like you, anything we can watch for you coming up, or anything you want to promote, or where we can see you and hear your podcast, all that stuff?
We'll link everything.
I've got two podcasts. If you're into basketball, one of them is called Pod Don't Lie. I'm way too into basketball, so that's kind of where I get all that out. And then the other podcast is called We Might Be Drunk, and that's with Mark Normand. Basketball ones with Stavros Halkias, who's hilarious. And then I have two specials that are on YouTube. One is Up on the Roof, which is I shot during the pandemic, and the other one is I Got This, and they're both from last year. And I'll try to get another one out hopefully by the end of the year, but we'll see. I feel burnt out. I feel like I got nothing, so we'll see.
Yeah, everybody afterwards. But I'm always convinced the last thing I wrote is the last thing I will write.
Isn't that crazy? You just feel
you're never. Your level, it's amazing. You think you build confidence or a callus. I just never do. I always think like, fooled him again, but that was the last time.
And also this pandemic has been just terrible for creativity, because I'm a comic. I need to be at airports and be traveling and ideas popping in my head. I'm not J.D. Salinger. I'm not going to sit in a warehouse or whatever and just or like a barn and just crank out,
right.
You know, lines. I need motion. I need motion.
Well, we'll definitely link to those. We'll link to those specials and what. Anything you've been watching though on over the that you
so much, that you love. So much. I just finished that QAnon doc on HBO. I loved it. My god!
I haven't got into it yet.
Forum, right?
I loved it. Yeah, it's just completely nuts. And I like the guy, the filmmaker Cullen something, who made it, because he's not. It's so easy to just laugh at these QAnon people, and he's playing ball. He knows what he's got to do to make this a movie and make it watchable. Because some of these Q people, it's like one of the signs though, they turned into like just being anti-pedophilia. Because who the fuck is an anti-pedophilia? Yeah. So one of the signs was pedophilia is not a sexual orientation, and it's like, who the fuck is arguing that? I've never heard anyone make that argument.
What it was.
Right. No one says that. So it's just these kind of like trick, like, you know, these trick signs to get people engaged. Like somebody,
I'm going
to
take a big stand here against pedophilia. Wow. I usually don't get political, but I'm just going to be like, I am not for it. That's how
it's almost. It's almost easier to be a conspiracy theory nut than it is. It's so easy to be like, everything's bullshit. It's so easy. It drives me crazy.
I'm jealous of them to go through life that stupid. It's just like, it's fine. It's like, it's just like, because you don't have to argue anything. You don't have to believe it. And honestly, do pedophiles think about pedophilia as much as these people do? It's like, and they only care, but then when they actually, somebody on their side is actually being accused of pedophilia, they just completely ignore it. It's like right there. Trump used to walk into kids changing at his beauty pageants. He bragged about it on Stern. Like, are you not concerned? No, you think that's more less.
He's credible? The leader. He's the leader.
With Jeffrey Epstein, when, you know, like the right is like, look, here's a picture of him, Bill Clinton. You know,
like
is like, well, here he is with Donald Trump. It's like, no, they're both gross. Let's just say that.
Yeah, also, like, I feel like no one's defending Bill Clinton anymore. No. I feel like that ship has sailed. I feel like there was a period where people, but like, I feel like there's not a lot of people who are like, Clinton clearly is not a great human.
No, obviously he's not.
He's clearly not a good person.
But that's like always the argument I hear from the other side. I mean, like, when I look on Facebook, I mean, I grew up in Texas, so there's a lot of, you know, when I look on Facebook at people I grew up with, and they're like, well, look at what Clinton, like, that's the excuse. It's like, that's the automatic. Well, Trump did
what about it?
Clinton. Well, look at what Clinton did. It's like, well, we're not talking about, don't.
We're also like, most of us are like, okay, cool. Like, if they find out that he's guilty of this shit, put him in jail. Now your turn. Now it's your turn. Now, if you find Trump, you guys do the same thing, like, you go.
Yeah. How about just no pedophiles?
No, it's funny. They're more rigid than anyone. It's so weird. They get one sign. They're like, it's all coming to fruition. Like everything we picked, but they don't realize that, like, it's like they're the same as those people that are like, the world's going to end in 1999. Right. The world's going to end. You're the same as that religious nut job that you claim to hate.
Right. And it's not that, like, these crazy conspiracy theories. It's like, if you believe that a guy like Donald Trump gives a shit about you and the working man, like, if you can make that leap, you can't believe anything. That's the biggest conspiracy.
That's true.
That is by far the craziest conspiracy that they believe, is that this fucking New York trust fund asshole who doesn't give a shit about any of them, who literally said, go to the Capitol, I'm right behind you, then hit out, watch it on TV, and laughed at you. And if you think, like, he's on your side, that's the nuttiest conspiracy. That's much crazier than us all drinking baby blood.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, I'm watching that tonight.
Danny, what have you got for us?
Okay, this is going to sound like all hoity-toity, but I just started. It's kind of good. I'm watching the Ken Burns Hemingway doc. I just finished the first one.
I heard it's amazing. I just read that article in the New Yorker about it I didn't like that. They had like the last line where they're like, Hemingway wanted to be a woman or something because he was in love with Gertrude Stein. I'm like, what are you talking about? This is the wokest shit I've ever heard.
No, it's interesting. I mean, he's obviously like this incredibly complicated guy just based on the first one, but he was like, I don't know. He's insanely talented and driven, but he was just like, the first one they're just talking about. So his experiences in the war, he came back, it was horrible, but he completely immediately started lying and self-aggrandizing his heroism in the war, like right away, like in a way that like you understand. I there was something I related to about like, you're getting adulation for that. You're a young man. You never want to go back, but he's a complicated guy. I mean, I'm obviously a fan of his writing. So, but it's fascinating.
Oh, he's where the best. Is
that? What's that on?
That's like the one. That's like the one book you get when you're in high school where you're like, yes, you get so amped up.
Yeah, like The Sun Also Rises. You're like, yeah.
Oh my God, that ending is so. That's like my favorite ending to a book ever. Where it's just literally heartbreaking, but also just kind of so.
Absolutely.
I don't know. It's not over the top. It's just like quietly heartbreaking ending. I love that.
And they talk about how it's really based on a lot of the shit that happened and his group of friends in Paris and after the war and there. But there's an amazing thing where there's a guy in their group. This, I forgot the guy's name, a Jewish guy who was like part of their group. And his fictionalized version is just like this like gross Jew, like in Sun Also Rises, is kind of like
Cone. Is that Cone?
Yeah. And it was based, and it's like, and I was so hard. Like, so this whole time you just thought of me as the Jew, and it was like, holy shit! It's like talking about putting somebody in your act. I mean, I guess that's always been a thing, you know.
That's amazing. You know,
so applies. Okay. So I haven't watched all of it. It's quite lengthy, but I'll check that.
It's on PBS, right?
PBS, yeah. And the PBS
app.
Yeah, man, it's been a fucking pleasure having you.
Yeah, no, I love talking to you guys. This was fun. Yeah.
This was so much fun. I really
appreciate it. My lighting is so weird. The clips are so fucking.
No, you look gorgeous. Don't worry.
Right.
Yeah, anyway. It's going to look great.
Oh, yeah. Somebody just like light me out. I look like pink. Thank you for having us, man. Thank you for being a part of our show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Yeah, no, this is fun. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for picking me.
And everybody check out.
Tell me when it comes out.
Oh, we will.
We'll do. I'll send you the link and everything.
Cool.
But we appreciate it. Thank you for coming on, Sam. And we'll link all your specials and everything to the podcast. So
Thanks, Doing It
Nation. We're trying that out.
We're trying Doing It Nation. We're giving it a shot. And thank you, Guy.
Thank you, Guy.
Thanks, Guy.